Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
Okay, round two. Name something that's not boring.
A laundry? Ooh, a book club. Computer solitaire, huh?
Ah, oh, sorry. We were looking for Chumba Casino. That's right. Chumbacasino.com has over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
You're listening to the Manchester United Weekly Podcast. Your hosts are Harry Robinson and Jack Tate. We talk about the latest going-ons at United, look ahead to our next game, and give you an update on the youth side, the club's loanees, and Casey Stoney's women's team. Enjoy the show. Welcome back to the Manchester United Weekly Podcast. Today we're throwing ourselves back to March the 7th, United's last league game, a 2-0 win against City. And then we're considering the way in which the Premier League has returned, how the FA Cup and Europa League should return, with United having a chance in both of those competitions. And perhaps more importantly, we're previewing Manchester United's first game in 3 months, a Premier League away match at Tottenham Hotspur on Friday evening. Jack, the only place to start, having said all of that, is with the absolute hero, the absolute boss man that is Marcus Rashford, who by the end of the year you would think could be the BBC Sports Personality of the Year, could have the keys to the city of Manchester, whatever he likes, because everything he's done. I mean, it's this weird sense. I have this weird sense of pride for Marcus Rashford, not being a member of his family, not even having grown up in Withenshaw where he grew up. And yet, I feel proud of everything he's done. And most people will know what he's done, but everything he's done over the last 3 months during the coronavirus pandemic has been incredible.
Yeah, you know, we just talked on the last episode about all the injustices that are facing the world. And especially, you know, someone like Marcus Rashford, a black boy growing up in a pretty, you know, poor neighbourhood in Greater Manchester. And now he's not only has sort of made it to where he is today, but now the, you know, the sort of philanthropic work that he's doing, the way he's giving back, and not just giving back, throwing money at things and hoping that something sticks, actually, you know, taking action and really doing things himself to try and improve other people's lives around him. It's really inspiring to watch. You know, he's just been lobbying Boris Johnson to give out free school meals over the summer to kids that have to do summer schoolwork. He's been incredible for the entire time that he's been out. And he is, you're right, a wonderful example, I think, of everything that a Manchester United player, and to be fair, any footballer should be, and the kind of role model that he is, his story growing up in, you know, like I said, not the best place in Manchester, and you know, making it as a footballer and not forgetting where he's come from. He's always stayed true to his roots and given back to, you know, to Withenshaw and the city of Manchester.
Yeah, and it's not just that he's given a significant amount of his money to charity. It's not just that he's helped to raise 20 million for Fair Share, which helps to feed, I think it's 200 or 300,000 kids every week across the country who are suffering from the fact that they no longer get free school meals, or simply their families just don't have enough money to feed them. Such is the state of poverty in the UK that we often forget too much. But it's the manner in which he's done it as well. He's done it without. It's a strange thing to say, but the reason he's been able to perhaps get more support than others is because he's done it without making anyone feel bad. He's done it without attacking any people in particular. He's done it by kind of bringing all of these communities together, and that's quite a skill to have for a 21, 22 year old kid And Withyn Shaw is an area of South Manchester, which is, yeah, it's an area with quite a lot of poverty. Its two most famous things are probably Marcus Rashford and Withyn Shaw Hospital. And it's had its problems with gun crime and poverty and issues on estates and gangs. But it's also a massive community where of working class people who help each other out, and for Rashford to do this is brilliant, and it does make you feel proud in a weird sense. Right, let's go to back to March the 7th. Scott McTominay has just scored from 35 yards against Manchester City, and it was a rainy night in Manchester, and it was, you know, it seems so far away, but it was so good. And the reason I wanted to go back to this is not just out of a sense of going back, but because I think it is worth reminding ourselves of what position we were in before football stopped. And it was our last league game, as extraordinary as that is to say. And I think it's good to look back at it, appreciate how good it was, and also some of the tactical points from it. The fact that Luke Shaw and Williams started in that kind of left-back pivoty thing, which was a bit strange. And that was one of these Ole Gunnar Solskjaer kind of not massive, but quite important small tactical innovations that have brought United quite a lot of success this season.
We never quite got the chance to do a full review of that City game, and it's important, I think, that we do give it the time that it deserves now, because it was a truly a memorable occasion at Old Trafford, one of the best that we've seen in a long, long time. You know, the Manchester derby for the last sort of 3 years or so has strangely been dominated by the away teams. You know, we've done very well at the Etihad, have scored quite a few good victories there, but we've been pretty comfortably beaten at Old Trafford in pretty much every game since Pep Guardiola has taken charge at the Etihad. So it was nice to finally get one over them in front of our own fans at Old Trafford. And you're right, Solskjaer's tactical changes, I mean, for the whole season really have been slightly better, and especially since Christmas, and then even more so just in general against Pep Guardiola. He seems to have Pep's number at the moment. He's now, I think, alongside Mourinho, the only manager to have beaten Pep three times in a season, after doing the double in the league and then also beating him in the second leg of the Carabao Cup semi-final. You know, that's no small achievement, and it's testament to, I think, Solskjaer's growth as a manager. You know, it's always a difficult one to judge with Solskjaer, because he still hasn't been in the job for that long. But it's positive signs, at least, that there does seem to be a lot of growth from him. And exactly the same way that we expect, you know, growth from our players, from our signings, we should also be expecting growth from our managers, and especially one like Solskjaer, who's still relatively inexperienced. And I think we are starting to see that, which is at least a positive, even if he doesn't get everything right all the time.
Yeah, and there's been plenty during the break of people kind of doing kind of an evaluation of Ole Gunnar Solskjaer, and I think the conclusion will change over the next few weeks, depending on whether we finish fourth, fifth or sixth, depending on whether we qualify for the Champions League. We're not sure what's going to happen with City yet. We'll know in the next few days or at least in the next couple of weeks, I think, about their European ban, which would change whether United, if they finish fifth, go into the Champions League or Europa League. But I think we've seen growth from Solskjaer, and I think someone like Aaron Wan-Bissaka, who was brilliant in that City game and shut down Sterling, Scott McTominay obviously scored in that. And Fred had a great game against City as well. And those three players that kind of sum up Solskjaer's qualities in the way that he has led to improvements in specific players. I think we should talk about the present now. The Premier League is returning, and it was, I think, if I cast my mind back 2 or 3 weeks, I think this was much more of a debate than it is now. And in a way, that's strange, because although the number of deaths in the UK has gone down in the last couple of weeks, even a week ago, it hadn't dropped that much. The death toll and the number of people and the number of families being bereaved by the coronavirus. And yet football was coming back. I think now the general consensus is that, and this is either because everyone's kind of just thought, well, it's happening, so we'll accept it, or it's because people want to cast their minds elsewhere. But now I think the general consensus is, well, it's come back, and that's probably the right decision.
Yeah, I mean, without wanting to make this this into a sort of Daily Mail or The Guardian podcast on the UK's coronavirus policy, but I think, you know, it's been a bit of a mess, to be honest with you, the whole thing. I was very surprised when it was announced the Premier League would come back. I think it was probably, for me, a couple of weeks too early. Just the optics of, you know, being able to put all the resources and the money and all the testing infrastructure into the Premier League coming back, you know, which really started in earnest sort of the last week of May, when, as you said, there were still sort of 300-400 deaths every single day in the UK at that point, and we still didn't have enough tests for people. And so the optics of then allowing the Premier League to conduct thousands of tests, you know, three times a week is not the best. But I mean, from a selfish point of view, I'm very happy that the Premier League has come back, because it's going to make my summer a lot more enjoyable. It's going to make all of us, you know, our esteem, just that give us that boost that will be nice. But I am quite surprised that it came back quite so quickly. You know, you look at other countries that have managed to bring back football, especially Germany, sort of being the main one in Europe, and you know, they handled the crisis so much better with very, very few deaths and very few cases. I worry slightly that this may not help, but it looks like they have put, you know, a lot of thought into how everything's being done. There's been a lot of precautions taken so far. So just fingers crossed everything kind of works out as we hope.
Yeah. Yeah. I think if you want some more detail on the, not the moral implications of bringing the Premier League back, which I certainly, 2 or 3 weeks ago, I did have some concerns, and I'll talk about them in a second. But if you want some more detail in terms of the science behind Project Restart, as it's been called, there's a good podcast called Football Today, which spoke to someone who has far better scientific knowledge than we do about the actual science behind this, and the likelihood of players spreading the coronavirus, the testing that's required. And the key point is that the UK's test and trace system has been so shambolic that it really can't be compared to Germany. And that's where the big problem lies. And I mean, we saw a Norwich player having played a friendly against Spurs test positive for coronavirus. United play Spurs on Friday, and there seems to be no suggestion that one Norwich player having been tested positive, having come into contact with the Tottenham players, will have any effect on the Premier League schedule. And it seems a bit strange, but ultimately money is king in this situation. I think it's probably best to move past the moral considerations that I did have, because the one thing I did think was that people came out, and N'Golo Kante, for example, was training by himself at Chelsea. His brother died last year of a heart problem, I think it was, and he clearly didn't want to take a risk. Troy Deeney was saying he's got a young kid at home with breathing problems. He didn't want it. And all of these were obviously individual cases. And I thought, I understand why people say, oh, well, they're players, they should get back on with their jobs. But the reality is that these were individual cases. I think the response to them made me frustrated. But I think in general, bringing football back had to be done at some point, because like any other industry, there are serious consequences. These are there's people's jobs on the line that aren't footballers because of the stopping of football, and it needed to come back to support that industry.
Yeah, I mean, it's certainly worth thinking about the implications that this will have on sort of wider people than just Premier League players. Like you said, all of the staff involved who wanting to get back to their jobs, all of the people who this will help support them in their jobs. You know, it looks like pubs may reopen soon, which, although I'm again not particularly happy about the prospect of that, when it's still quite a big risk in the UK, it will at least, you know, help a lot of people in getting back to work and financially helping them get back on their feet.
Yeah.
So, you know, the implications of this are far wider reaching. And, you know, I don't doubt that the Premier League have done, you know, all of their due diligence on the issue, and they have far smarter people than myself, you know, deciding on all of this. And, you know, to be fair, I think so far they have had, you know, very good testing plans in place, and have, I think, engaged with the concerns of some players relatively well. The thing that is just still worries me is, of course, you know, what happens if one player, especially a high profile player, is sick, or if one team goes down. You know, I'm taken back to I think it was it 2007, 2008, when Spurs on the final day
had like half of their scandal.
Of their squad. Yeah, exactly. Taken out because of food poisoning, and allowed Arsenal to get fourth place ahead of them. You know, it's just a scenario like that would be really, really, really poor for the Premier League to have to deal with. And I think that is kind of the main worry here, you know, because so many players are asymptomatic because they're healthy, and but they can still give it to other people. It's just the potential for that kind of scandal is high.
Yeah, and I think my main problem with the whole thing was the use of football as, well, I mean, the phrase a political football applies more to other things normally, but football was being used as a kind of a political weapon in the same way that I think pubs are. Is that bringing football back an easy way to get the public on side, bringing pubs back an easy way to get the public on side. But there are lots of other things, which lots of other industries as well, the important thing, that won't be brought back because the balance between the risk of spreading coronavirus and the benefits of bringing it back to the public are different. Whereas football, I think, as an industry, is willing to take that risk, and the government as well is willing to take that risk, because the benefits of enjoyment and public morale, I guess, are bigger. But I think the Bundesliga we're going to talk about, because they've been back for a few weeks and it is a different situation. But one really interesting point I read about the Bundesliga, if you can remember, yeah, Joshua Kimmich's goal in Der Klassiker between Bayern Munich and Dortmund, which was one of, I think it was the second or third game back for those two sides. A wonderful goal. But a writer called Joshua Robinson for the Wall Street Journal looked into it, and a really interesting point emerged. And because players have had to be training by themselves, because they've been isolating, and what can you train by yourself? You can't do tactics. You can't do passing. You can do individual training, which is generally unopposed dribbling, which has few benefits, fitness, or shooting into an empty net. And then as things progress, to be fair, into a net with a socially distanced goalkeeper, if you like. And he looked into this and discovered that because these players have had the chance to practice shooting, which is something that elite footballers don't really get the chance to do, so that the conversion rate in the Bundesliga has gone up. So the percentage of shots that turn into goals. So for Bayern, it's gone up by a significant amount. Dortmund's too. And actually five of the top six teams are now finishing more chances than they were before the break. And that's kind of one of these changes in football that is weird to consider. And it is true, elite footballers have never really had the chance to practice shooting since they turned 16 or 17, because training, because there's so many games, is normally a mixture of recovery, some small tactical points going into a big game, not necessarily improving on your shooting, on your dribbling, on your passing, like a specific or underused part of your game. And that's a shame, maybe, which just shows. Imagine how good some players could be if they had the opportunity, as they have done now, to work on their shooting. So we'll see if it has the same effect in the Premier League. Maybe we'll see it from Martial, Rashford, but probably the bigger effect will be on the players who aren't normally practicing their shooting, the midfielders like Kimmich, yeah, or in United's case, like Fred or McTominay.
You know, I wonder if it might help someone like Dan James. So yeah, I spoke on the last episode that I think he might be someone to watch out for coming out of this break. And he's exactly that kind of person. You know, he needed time to be able to work on sort of the technical aspects of his game, which, as crazy as it sounds, you're right, players don't actually get that much time to practice normally. And it seems silly, because it seems like such a foundational thing. But is that, you know, think, yeah, about yourself and your own training sessions. Any of you have played kind of like amateur football, it's true. In training sessions, how often do you really practice your own technical things? It's more group work or tactical stuff that, yeah, you train. And the other thing that I wonder, and I noticed this in the very brief highlights of the two friendlies that we played against West Brom, mostly in the case of Marcus Rashford, was I wonder if players will be able to come back using sort of a few more skills and tricks as well, because that's another thing that you can kind of do on your own. And it's the kind of thing that, you know, players, when the little boy in them comes out, still want to try and, you know, show off in their back garden and you know, skill up the garden pot that they would have put down as the defender or something. Yeah. And I noticed in the highlights of the friendly against West Brom, you know, Marcus Rashford had three or four different occasions where he's pulling out different tricks. I mean,
a couple of roulettes here.
Yeah,
and
I think there was a McGeady spin in there as well. And, you know, he already uses in quite a lot. He uses the flip flap quite a lot. But I wonder if we'll see a few more players being able to kind of pull some of those out of the bag now they've had a bit more time to practice.
Yeah, yeah, it's an interesting thing, and I think we will be looking for differences in football, and I think a lot of the focus will be on fitness, yeah, on how Solskjaer sets his United side up with Pogba and Bruno Fernandes and the speed of the game. But I think actually these tiny little things, which you'd never normally think about, might be quite interesting. So we will be looking out to see if Dan James's shooting is better. And then I'm sure someone with access to all the statistics will write an article on it or something.
Yeah. I've got to say, there's one thing that's good about sports coverage in the US generally. There seems to be a lot more acceptance of using analytics data over here, which is nice. And I think that, like that article in the Wall Street Journal, it's nice to kind of see those sort of stats used, because it's undoubtedly what football teams are using. We just don't really see it very much in the mass media in the UK. So I think it'd be good if we could normalise some more use of those kind of stats, places like StatBomb and stuff like that.
I think the difference in, this is not a United point, but more of a football media point. I think the difference in the two countries is getting slimmer, but I think the problem that the UK has with football stats is, to a lot of us, well, what happens is the people that do focus on these stats, the majority of them, the very good ones obviously do it very well, but I think the majority of them just put the numbers out sometimes. And you get a lot of these Twitter accounts who have access to Opta or Yscout or something, and they'll put out a tweet saying, these were the numbers. And you think, well, okay, but I could work out what that means if I really wanted to, but why don't you tell me? And I think the difference is, on the few occasions I have read stuff from the US, either on soccer or on their own sports, it's looking at the numbers and then telling the readers what that means. And I don't think we get enough of that. And maybe that will start to change, but that's kind of what you want. Because if someone's just spouting numbers at you, you're thinking, well, I don't really care. Just to tell me the message. And this was why that Wall Street Journal piece was good, because it was, shooting's improved because people have had a chance to work on it. Now that, to me, maybe it'll be boring to people listening to this, but to me, that was really interesting.
That's fascinating, yeah. I think another thing with the differences in the way that media writes about this too is that in Britain we have, and I think partly probably comes down to that most people in Britain have played or supported a team before, you know, kind of for their whole lives, is that we have a much more like romantic view of football as well, and that it's all down to the emotional connection and, you know, how much pride you have in wearing the shirt and stuff like that. And I think, I just think in the US there isn't that kind of football culture that has been built up yet. And so I think there is a bit more of like a step back, kind of more objective, almost more like clinical approach to it. Whereas we are definitely more sort of romanticists when it comes to the way that we view the game.
Yeah. Also, there might be something in the fact that college football is in American football, and college sport is so big that because Americans have the chance to kind of have two teams, there's kind of that separation between the elite professional level and the elite college level, which maybe gives more of an opportunity to have kind of different analysis at different level, whereas football naturally is very hierarchical, and there is the elite and this is the way it's covered, and there is the smaller teams and that's the way it's covered. Anyway, in terms of how, if you've watched the Bundesliga, I've enjoyed it quite a lot. La Liga came back last week as well. I think it's been nice to have football again. There's no doubt about that. The question I want to ask is, fan noise plugged into stadiums, yes or no?
You know what? I was very, very against this when I first heard that the Bundesliga were considering bringing it back. I think there's such a stigma around it, especially when there are normally fans in the stadium. You know, we hear teams like Arsenal occasionally pumping like fan noise into the Emirates to increase the atmosphere, and you just think, oh, that's the stupidest thing I've ever heard. So I really wasn't very optimistic about it at all. But actually, having watched the games on TV, it's actually worked really, really well. I think it's been a great addition. Yeah. So I remember watching, the two games stick out in my mind before sort of football was shut down. One was England playing against Croatia immediately, their first game after the World Cup in 2018. And then also our game against LASK, our final game before the season was stopped. And both games were in behind closed doors. Yeah. In the Croatia game's case, because of racist abuse from Croatia fans and being handed a FIFA ban, and then against LASK because of coronavirus precautions. And both were, don't get me wrong, it's still football, you know, it's still great to watch, but it felt very eerie watching it. It felt just bizarre to be watching almost like what felt almost like a Sunday league game, but with elite level footballers. But then watching the Bundesliga games, it's felt, don't get me wrong, it still feels a little bit weird, you know, when they cut to the shot of a manager on the sideline and they're wearing a mask, or you get a shot of the stadium and there's no one there. But the crowd noise does just make it feel a little bit more normal. And I think the way they've done it in the Bundesliga, where I guess there's obviously someone controlling it with different options, different sounds they could play. There's people clapping when someone hits a good pass. There's people cheering when there's a goal. There's people, you know, moaning when someone makes a mistake, things like that. It actually works really, really well.
I'm imagining someone sat like in a room in the downstairs area of a stadium with kind of like a soundboard in front of him. I imagine it must be something like that, unless it's automated on, because obviously FIFA and Pro Evo managed to adjust sound noises to what goes on, so maybe it's automated, but I imagine it's someone doing it to make sure it's a bit more natural. I was the same as you. When it was first mentioned, I thought, no, absolutely no chances. This is an affront to fan culture, to football culture, and everything about it. And I there is a little bit of me that feels that still, but I think it works well. I think there was also a debate whether you just have it on TV or if you have it in the stand as well. The one thing I say about the stand, if you have it in the stadium while it's going on, it does open it up for a scandal. If you've got someone having control over the crowd noise, it obviously makes a difference to how players play, whether the crowd is loud or not. And if someone's about to pull the trigger on a shot, yeah, and you get the guy below the stadium launches kind of some ridiculous noise or police siren or something, then it occurred to me. But
DJ's mixing table and accidentally starts playing some drum and bass music or something over the speakers.
Yeah, exactly. I do think that something that does have to happen is some organisation, whether it's the Football Supporters Federation or something, has to make sure that before this becomes the norm, some kind of rule is put in place to say you can't pump noise into games if there are any fans in the stadium. Because I think it does open it up for future, because I know Arsenal have done it before games, but no one does it during games really, because it shouldn't happen. So I think someone needs to make sure that this is thought about before someone does it and before it becomes a debate whether it's allowed, because it definitely shouldn't be allowed. Right, Spurs on Friday night, 8:15 kickoff in an empty Tottenham Hotspur Stadium, the first time we've played there. I've been there. Well, I went for a pre-season game to see what it was like. It's a pretty impressive stadium. Especially their single tier, the largest single tier stand in Europe, it does look pretty good, and it all seems to be basically perfectly designed, much better than the Emirates in terms of how it is as a football stadium. Pogba, we spoke about this on the last episode, how you fit Pogba and Bruno in the same team. According to The Athletic, Paul Pogba won't start on Friday night. He hasn't played since Boxing Day, to be fair. So how do you think United will line up, and what are you expecting from this game?
I'm expecting quite a scrappy game, to be honest, more than anything. I think there's going to be a lot of mistakes,
yeah,
a lot of rust for the players to kind of kick off the cobwebs. But I'm excited. I think it's two teams who can play very, very entertaining football, but can also play very boring, very turgid football as well. As we ourselves know from Jose Mourinho's time as Man United manager, it can go one of two ways. And to be fair, we've played some very, very boring games this season, but also been involved in some crackers. So I'm slightly worried for how boring this game could be if both teams approach this game from a standpoint of, this is our first game back, we need to kind of take, you know, be cautious, you know, not take too many risks.
We need to win.
Well, exactly. We do need to win. And so I think we should be coming out of this. And ultimately, I think we're a better side than Tottenham, based on what we saw before the I don't even know what to call it. I was going to say the break, but that doesn't feel like a strong enough term to say what we have.
The enforced break from
football, yeah. Before the enforced break from football, we are a better side than Tottenham. And I think we should be going all out to try and win this game. In terms of how we set up, it looks from reports like Paul Pogba won't start. And, you know, I think it's worth bearing in mind he hasn't played since, was against Watford on Boxing Day, I think. So, you know, it's been a long time, so it doesn't really surprise me. So I'd expect in midfield, Fred, McTominay, Bruno Fernandes, with Rashford and Martial. And then, I mean, that's sort of the only major selection headache, I would think, for Solskjaer, is who's that third forward that you put in there. Do you play Juan Mata coming off the right? Do you play Jesse Lingard? Do you play Dan James? I don't really know how Tottenham are going to set up in this. It wouldn't surprise me if they sit quite deep, in which case maybe Juan Mata would be a better option. Defensively, for me, the back four pretty much picks itself in Wan-Bissaka, Lindelof, Maguire and Luke Shaw. I guess the only real conundrums there are whether you play Eric Bailly, who, you know, played in the friendlies against West Brom and did okay before the enforced break.
I don't think I'd bring him in yet. I think you've basically, I think the back four is pretty set to start with, unless he's going to go with a back three again, which is possible. But in that case, I think he'd probably start Shaw in that left centre-back role like he did against City and against Liverpool with Williams at left wing. But I think he'll probably go for the back four. And then I was predicting Matic to start instead, because I think he might want to save McTominay for the Wednesday game against Sheffield United. And if the options are good for now, because we play on Friday and Wednesday, that's a pretty significant break. But also, if you're starting Matic to come into the Sheffield United game, you've got McTominay, Pogba, Greenwood and Brandon Williams, Tuan Zebe, Eric Bailly, Diogo Dalot. You've got some decent options there. We'll see when players start picking up injuries again, which is undoubted. I noticed that Phil Jones got injured again,
at this point it's almost as big a meme as his face. You know, it's quite incredible.
I think he's the only player to get injured without any games. I haven't heard of any other injuries during this kind of period before. But the thing I was thinking about just a second ago is the problem for this restart is if you lose your first game, you're straight away in trouble. It's not like the start of the season where you've got five or six games to get into a rhythm. If we lose to Spurs, then suddenly we're under proper challenge. We're under proper pressure when we play Sheffield United on Wednesday. Chelsea can extend their advantages in fourth place. So it's you really have got to start this period really quickly. For example, it's not quite as important for us as say Arsenal, because if Arsenal lose their first game, which they probably will against City, but if they lose their first couple of games, they're out of the race completely. The same probably applies to Tottenham as well. So it could be really exciting.
Yeah, it could. And the games are going to be coming thick and fast. You know, it's pretty much, what, two games every other week, I think, and one game in those other weeks. And plus, we'll have Europa League and FA Cup games thrown in there as well. So there's not going to be any time for teams to rest at all. You know, it's going to be, where, like you said, at the start of the season, which this kind of feels relatively similar to, you have like four, five, maybe six games. You have about four, five, six games. Then you have the September international break. Then you come back, have another five or six games, and you have the October international break. So it is sort of all cut up. But this is going to be a straight, what is it, nine-game slap to the end, really, with no breaks. And for us, it could end up being 15 games, potentially, or more, if we get to the Europa League final and the FA Cup final.
Yeah, yeah. Although, in a way, because I would say, I wrote a piece for United We Stand in the June issue saying we should use this opportunity to kind of have a bit of an experiment with football league structures, because football is so stuck in its ways. And I generally agree with that. I think we should maintain the league system. I don't think it should be messed with, but we have got this opportunity to kind of have a one-off experiment. And in a way, I think this restart period at the end is kind of like what you would have if everyone played each other once and then split off into separate leagues to decide the champions, the Europa League spots, the relegation spots. Yeah. In a way, I think Scotland used to do it. I know Colombia still do it. There's quite a few leagues that do it.
Everyone a chance of winning a trophy that way. Even the mid-table teams will have something to play for at the end of the season.
Yeah, yeah, but it also gives you that kind of final 10 games where everything matters. It will kind of be a way to see how that works. So it could be exciting. Now, I will give you a short youth and loan update. Last episode, I told you what was going on with the women's team, so I'll just give you a quick update on Angel Gomez and Teden Mengi. So the Athletics say that United and Angel Gomez are, and I quote here, edging towards a new deal. His current one expires at the end of June on the 30th. The options are him leaving on June the 30th and looking for a new club, signing a new short-term deal at United until the end of this season, whenever it goes on to, or signing a long-term deal at United. I think option one and three are most likely. I think he'll either leave or sign a new long-term contract. The hold up is about him wanting some guarantees, or not really guarantees, but kind of a promise that he will get some game time, because in fairness, he hasn't been given that many chances under Mourinho or Solskjaer. If he signs, he'll earn about 25 grand a week, is what's being reported at the moment. Now, in training, 18-year-old Teden Mengi has been training with the first team. He's a really talented centre-back. I've been watching him for, I think, 5 years now, and he used to play in midfield for the under-16s, and he was kind of this storming midfielder with some great technique, but he'd score from midfield all the time, and he's moved back permanently into central defence, and he's really improved in the under-23s this season. I tweeted an article about Teden Mengi that I wrote for United We Stand, but I tweeted out the full article a couple of days ago, so you can see that on my Twitter. But also trading in the first team were Jimmy Garner, Teith Chong and Angel Gomez. Jack, I'll ask for your prediction for the Spurs game before we wrap up.
Let's go be positive. We'll go with a 3-1 victory for United with Rashford and Martial.
That is positive. I said this on the last episode, but I am most excited to see Marcus Rashford back, more so than I am to see United play Tottenham. Just because of everything he was doing before, how much excitement he was playing with before, but also the work he's been doing. I am excited to see the players, and this is not just Rash, but I'm also excited to see Dan James, Martial, Bruno. I'm excited to see them more than I'm excited for the United Spurs game itself. I'm going to go with a 2-1 United win, positive as well, but Rashford and Martial to score. And I'm not sure who's going to score for them, because I haven't watched Spurs enough and they've had too many injuries for me to even keep count. Right, thank you very much for listening, as always, to the Manchester United Weekly Podcast. For more from us throughout the week, you can find Jack on Twitter at
UTD Tate, T-A-I-T. And just on that note, I've recently relocated to Chicago in the US. So if there's anyone on Twitter who's involved with the Man United Supporters Club in Chicago or the Supporters Bar downtown. I know it's probably not open right now, but please give me a tweet. I'd love to find out a bit more and maybe come down one.
Yeah, do that. Or you can tweet at UTD Weekly Pod. That's the podcast Twitter, or my Twitter is at Harry Robinson 64 for our thoughts throughout the week. Right, thank you very much for listening as always. If you are enjoying this podcast, the one thing you can do to help us out is by going to Apple Podcasts and leaving us a review. You might think it's not much. It only takes half a minute, but it does help us massively. It helps more people find the podcast and listen to it. So do that if you're enjoying the show. It would be much appreciated. Right, have a great week. Enjoy football being back. Enjoy Manchester United being back. And let us know your thoughts on United's return. Goodbye.
Network. Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on chumbacasino.com. I looked over the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Coincidence? I think not. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere, even at 30,000 feet. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's chumbacasino.com and live the Chumba life.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.